You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune, and I will be joined by Richard, who will be reading from the Sun. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Headline news, you will never see freedom again, out of Lawrence. Denise Foley recalled the horrific, reoccurring nightmares where her younger sister, Claire Gravel, screams to help, for help over and over. And none of us were there, Foley tearfully said in Lawrence Superior Court. Foley said she waited 39 years, 9 months, and 9 days. But finally, on Thursday, she confronted her sister's killer, John Carey, just moments before he was sent to prison for the rest of his life. Claire's brutal murder at the age of 20 left a hole in the Gravels' tight-knit family from North Andover that could never be filled, Foley said. Losing Claire was difficult enough, but when watching her parents deal with the loss of a child was unbearable, she said. Claire's murder affected 5 generations of our family, Foley said. One by one, Gravel's 5 siblings took the stand Thursday to tell Judge Jeffrey Karp about their fun and family-loving sister, whose energy and dreams were cut short when Carey strangled her to death with her own tank top in 1986. Carey, 67, was convicted on March 3rd of murdering Gravel, who was a Salem State College student from North Andover. Jurors found him guilty of first-degree murder with extreme atrocity and cruelty, which carries an automatic penalty of life in prison without the possibility of parole. He was convicted nearly 40 years after Gravel's body was found off the highway in Beverly. The trial spanned several weeks with Karp presiding. Gravel's case was one of the area's longstanding cold cases that was investigated over the years by Elaine Gill, a retired state police detective lieutenant who initially investigated the murder when she was just 24. She's now the deputy police chief at Merrimack College in North Andover. Attending the sentencing Thursday in Lawrence Superior Court was Gravel's family. Gill, fellow retired state police lieutenant Stephen Bucheri, and Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker. Also present were some of Gravel's friends and even English teacher Paul Gregoire, who remembered Gravel with her time at North Andover High School. She was a spitfire. She was feisty, Gregoire said. Donna Gravel spoke in court about how her sister was just 5 weeks short of her 21st birthday. Similarly to her sister, Denise, Donna spoke about how we lost part of my mother when we lost Claire. You are an evil, mean, dangerous, remorseless person, she said. You belong in prison for the rest of your natural life. Her older brother, Bob Gravel, said it haunts him to this day that he wasn't there that night to save Claire. She wanted to go everywhere and do everything. You look at her and he said, I take comfort in knowing you will never see freedom again. If anyone deserves life in prison, it is you. When asked if they wanted to address the court, Carey's attorney, Mark Booker, said an appeal of the murder conviction has been filed. Carey, formerly of Gloucester and Hamilton, was charged with Gravel's murder in 2022 after prosecutors said his DNA was found on a tank top the young woman was wearing when she was found. Prosecutors said Carey strangled the young woman to death with her top for sexual gratification. She was left seen leaving Major Magleish's bar in Salem, Massachusetts, where she had met friends after a softball game. The DNA match didn't occur until after Carey was convicted in 2007 in a strangulation attempt murder case and was serving a state prison sentence. He was indicted and arraigned on the murder charge in 2022. Numerous witnesses called by prosecutors were current or retired state troopers. Jurors also heard testimony from a number of crime scene and forensic experts, including those assigned to the State Police Crime Lab. As part of the trial, jurors were also bused to Salem and Beverly to see multiple sites associated with the trial. We will never know who Claire Gravel would have been. John Kerry shattered her dreams and her family. She was fun and friendly and feisty. What a great mother she would have been, said Assistant District Attorney Kim Fettiella, noting that Gravel was a loyal friend and the favorite baby sister in the neighborhood. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, the Lowell Sun for Friday, April 10th. We seem to have some sun is coming in with a high temperature of 68 and a low of 48. And the banner has Wilmington's. A hydrofluoric acid leak triggers hazmat team. Then under sports, the Bruins, Higgins arrives, but timing of debut is unclear. And under nutrition, quick fix, quick and easy beef kebabs and pearl couscous. All right. Well, the big article on the front page is U.S. Rep. Jim McGovern speaks to the press after he became the first lawmaker to conduct an unannounced oversight visit to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Burlington on April 8th. However, McGovern said ICE honored a court order mandating that lawmakers be allowed inside ICE facilities for unannounced visits, but did not allow his staff to join him. I saw the human cost of this cruelty up close, the congressman said. Article by Peter Currier. On Wednesday, U.S. Rep. Jim McGovern became the first lawmaker to make the unannounced visit to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Burlington, which has been under scrutiny for the last year over alleged poor conditions for detainees inside. McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts, 2nd Congressional District, said in a post on social media afterwards that he conducted the visit unannounced because the law gives members of Congress the right to inspect these facilities without warning. We continue having to sue to ensure the administration complies with the law. We continue winning, said McGovern's post. The American people deserve the truth. When an administration is rounding people up, hiding behind locked doors, and constantly lying, Congress has a responsibility to show up and ask questions and demand answers. McGovern said ICE honored a court order mandating that lawmakers be allowed inside the ICE facility, but not with their staff. What I saw was very concerning. They are detaining people who should not be there at all. They are targeting people who are part of our community. They are not going after the worst of the worst, said McGovern. Inside that facility, I saw the human cost of this cruelty up close. This is not about safety. It's not about justice. It's about fear, dehumanization, and administration that treats decent people like they are disposable. McGovern continued, Trump lied. He is going after good people, decent people, people who belong with their families and in their communities, not detained in an ICE facility. The American people need to see this for what it is. It is wrong, and I'm not going to stay quiet. All right, page 8. Okay. Let me get it. 6, 7. All right. 8. Oh, yeah, yay. Yeah. This is big. All right. They rounded up alleged illegal immigrant workers with a roofing company from the parking lot of a Bridge Street business. One day before the city's preliminary election in September, agents were again spotted in Lowell conducting Patriot 2.0 operations, which raised concerns among state and local leaders about the chilling effect their presence could have on the voting process. The series of citywide ICE raids prompted new city councilor Sean McDonough to submit a motion in January asking city manager Tom Golden whether there was any cooperation or request for cooperation between ICE and the Lowell Police Department. In his response, Udon, police captain, stated that we have had no request to cooperate with ICE, a position affirmed by Golden. ICE has not requested, and we are as surprised when they appear in Lowell as well, Golden told the councilors. Udon had previously addressed the council at a February 11, 2025 meeting about the department's official policy for interacting with ICE. Several councilors expressed their support for the Lowell Police Department while also speaking to the distrust sowed in the community towards local law enforcement based on the actions of what Councilor Vesna Noon called a careless, lawless federal agency operating in the community with unchecked powers. Oops. We know that ICE is not here for the safety of our community. We know that they terrorize our community. The question of public safety was raised by Councilor Sidney Liang, who wondered what people in the community should do when masked men come and knock on their door. Would the police go if they call 911 or not? Liang asked. What should they do? Although the 911 call question was not addressed, Nguyen asked Golden if he would allow ICE access to city resources to conduct their operation. If they asked me, I would say no, Golden said. The majority of the public messaging on ICE, to the community has been generated by nonprofit and immigrant advocacy groups that advise residents to know your rights and to contact them for suspected ICE activity. But no telephone number. Other councilors noted that immigration was a federal issue and asked Golden to focus on ways to clarify the policy already in place in the city, which was last updated in 2015. I think the police policy written in 2015 is vague. Belinda Duran said, we can do a better job, but without feeling like we have to solve the world's problems. Echoing Liang's concerns about community policing, McDonough spoke at length about an incident last year at a residential building in downtown Lowell in which he said he saw footage of masked men, well-armed men with armor who are not clearly identified, roaming the corridors with long guns. We can say that's probably ICE, he said, but they're not reaching out to the police department beforehand. Someone calls 911 and says, there's a man with a rifle, or there's five men with rifles running around my neighborhood. I think we do owe the residents of the city an outline of when that call comes in. What steps Lowell Police is taking to confirm that it is the federal government and not just people throwing somebody in a van or running around a building with a long gun. McDonough thanked Udon for the response, but said there was very little that Lowell Police can do here. By voice vote, the council unanimously passed Councilor Kim Scott's motion to have City Solicitor Corey Williams report on any policy changes that the city could make that would not be just symbolic. Anything that's anything that he's aware of that we should be adopting, she said. The lone public speaker on the motion was Marcos Candido, who pushed a more aggressive response to federal encroachment on local rights and community policy, policing. This council must show that it is willing to act in the face of these clear violations of law by ICE, he said. We need an ordinance banning all forms of cooperation with ICE regarding civil immigration matters. All right.
Well, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Select Board plans a meeting about Police Chief Gray out of North Andover. The Select Board plans to hold an executive session concerning Police Chief Charles Gray, but city officials have yet to set the date. Town Manager Melissa Rodriguez confirmed on Thursday that the session is related to Gray, who also remains on active duty after two North Andover police unions announced a vote of no confidence in Gray and called for his removal. The executive session, originally scheduled for Monday, listed an agenda item that's typically cited for personnel issues. Under Massachusetts general law, such executive sessions are called to discuss the reputation, character, physical condition, or mental health, rather than professional competence of an individual, or discuss the discipline or dismissal of, or complaints or charges against, a public officer, employee, staff member, or individual. On Thursday, Rodriguez and Select Board Chair Janice Phillips said the initial meeting's notice and agenda was scheduled and publicly posted within the last 24 hours. The notice of executive session was available on the website along with its mention in the town's calendar on the government website on Thursday. However, it was pulled sometime in the afternoon after it was determined Monday's date did not work for all the parties involved, Rodriguez said. The Select Board and Rodriguez are actively rescheduling the meeting. The no confidence vote was taken among the North Andover Patrol Officers and Sergeants Union on April 1st. The union cited the June 30th shooting of former Andover police officer Kelsey Fitzsimmons, which involved multiple North Andover officers, as one example of a pattern of leadership failures under Gray during his tenure. The union members called the turmoil the department has faced following the outcome of the Fitzsimmons case as foreseeable and avoidable. The union said in a prepared statement how they advocated for the department to implement a body-worn camera program as they recognized the current societal need for video evidence to protect officers and ensure transparency. The union said Gray has proven unable to fulfill the basic qualifications of an effective leader, and they reached a tipping point where they couldn't remain silent while operating under a toxic culture of vindictiveness and professional stagnation. Unfortunately, the consequences are landing squarely on our officers and our town, the prepared statement read. Gray, 52, has served as chief since 2016. His contract was renewed last year and had no changes in terms for his previous contract with the town. His total compensation for fiscal 2026 is $205,099, which includes his base pay, an educational stipend, and other compensation. Gray and the North Andover Police Department were subjected to an outside management review in 2020 after a female officer filed a sexual harassment discrimination complaint in 2019. Municipal Resources Incorporated, a consulting firm based in Plymouth, New Hampshire, conducted the management study. Its report recommended upper management training and mentoring for Gray. The report also suggested the chief hold regular staff meetings, respond to staff inquiries within 2 days, establish regular office hours, and use the chain of command to ensure consistent communication throughout the organization to ensure the elimination of damaging rumors and innuendo. In 2023, Rodriguez said Gray had participated in different trainings within the town and with the Essex County Chiefs of Police Association. The union members on Wednesday said the management review was performed after the union raised similar concerns about Gray's leadership within the department as the members had now the prepared statement read. A report was produced, but the recommendations made to the chief of police have been largely ignored, the union member said. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, here we go. Wilmington. Hydrofluoric acid leak triggers major hazmat response. Photograph shows the Wilmington firefighters stand ready as hazmat technicians lower a damaged 55-gallon drum containing hydrofluoric acid from a trailer in the parking lot of 100 Progress Way on the 3rd of April. Okay, fire crews contain highly corrosive acid found next to explosive ammonium nitrate. Combination is not good. Article by Aaron Curtis. A leaking 55-gallon drum of hydrofluoric acid triggered a large-scale hazmat operation last week after firefighters discovered the corrosive chemical stored in the same trailer as the ammonium nitrate, an explosive substance that could react violently with acids. Whoops. While there was no danger to the public at large, the chemicals at this scene pose significant health and safety risks. Wilmington Fire Chief William Kavanaugh III said in a press release from the State Department of Fire Services, firefighters arrived in parking lot of 100 Progress Way on the morning of April 3rd after employees at the location reported the leaking drum containing hydrofluoric acid inside a parked trailer. Crews evacuated nearby personnel, established a safety perimeter, and called in the Department of Fire Services Hazardous Materials Emergency Response Division. Now, there's a label. Whoa. Once hazmat technicians confirmed that ammonium nitrate was also present in the trailer, the incident commander elevated the response from the Tier 2 to Tier 3 to bring in additional personnel and equipment to the scene. The release states, in total, 40 specialists equipped with protective suits, monitoring tools, and neutralizing agents responded to the scene. Wilmington firefighters maintain command throughout the day, coordinating with state hazmat teams, medical personnel, and technical experts. According to the release, members of the Department of the Fire Services Joint Page 5. Let's see, we have page 5. 4 or 5, okay. Okay, hazmat incident response team, trained to handle reactive and energetic materials, were deployed to safely remove the ammonium nitrate. A hazmat liaison also worked with a local hospital, treating the truck driver as a precaution. Hazmat crews in level A suits, the highest level of protective gear used when dealing with dangerous hazard materials, made multiple entries into the trailer. Eventually locating the punctured drum, and lowering it out upside down to stop the leak. They found no additional damage to other containers. But what did the puncturing? By the evening hours, the release states that technicians had neutralized the spilled hydrofluoric acid, and sealed the damaged drum inside a larger overpack filled with stabilizing material, whatever that is. A drone monitored the container's temperature until it was safe for transfer to a private cleanup contractor. What do they do with that? The trailer remained on site until Monday when crews returned to oversee removal of the remaining chemicals. These chemicals pose an immediate danger to life and health, State Fire John Marshal Devine says, State Fire.
Fire Marshal.
Okay. In the release, fortunately, we had seamless coordination among local and state personnel, all grounded in safety and science. Every step was made carefully, methodically, and professionally, from the first responding firefighters to the last entry team. Okay.
All right. House bans social media sites for young teens out of Boston. The State House of Representatives has approved legislation to ban social media use for children under the age of 14 and set tough statewide restrictions on cell phones in public schools. The Democratic-led proposal, which passed 129-25 Wednesday on a largely party-line vote, would require Facebook, Instagram, and other social media platforms to block users 14 and younger. The companies will be required to get verifiable parental consent, for users age 14 or 15 and give parents access to data and content submitted by minors. This bill will protect children from harmful content and addictive algorithms that ensure that our students are able to focus in the classroom without the distraction from cell phones, House Speaker Ron Mariano, a Quincy Democrat, said ahead of the vote. Social media companies are increasingly blamed for the rising rates of depression, suicide, and other mental health issues among young people nationally. In response, states and local governments are increasingly considering legislation and legal action to crack down on social media use. Parent groups, including Parents Collective Incorporated and Phone Free Action, are pursuing state and the federal government to approve the bans. Governor Maura Healey's office announced earlier this week that she would be holding a briefing Tuesday to unveil new social media regulations, but the event was abruptly canceled. No reason was given by her staff members. Attorney General Andrea Campbell is among a bipartisan group of 42 attorney generals suing Meta and other social media outlets, alleging features on Facebook and Instagram are addictive and aimed at kids and teens. It is critical that we hold tech companies accountable for designing social media platforms that keep young people addicted to and wreak havoc on their mental health, Campbell said in a statement. I am grateful that the legislature is taking this issue seriously, and I look forward to working with them on next steps. The bill will require school districts to educate students in age-appropriate ways about the responsible use of social media, including potential harms to emotional and mental health and bullying. While the proposal will require social media platforms to provide data submitted by teens to their parents if requested, it would prohibit the companies from sharing information about a minor's LGBTQ+ status with them. The House bill also seeks to restrict smartphone use during the school day by requiring districts to ban students from using personal electronic devices during school hours. The proposal also calls for a pilot program in 10 school districts to test technology that makes students' smartphones and other electronic devices inoperable on school grounds during the school day. The Senate approved a similar bell-to-bell cell phone ban last year, but it didn't include a social media ban. Differences between both bills would need to be worked out by negotiators before a final version heads to Healey's desk. If the legislation is approved, Massachusetts would join a growing number of states, including New Hampshire, California, Florida, and New York, to ban or restrict cell phones in schools, part of a broader effort to remove classroom distractions for students as concerns about their mental health mount. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, here we go. Iran War. Article by Rio Yamat of Associated Press. Travelers face higher costs and fewer flight options as jet fuel prices swing. A new reality is setting in for travelers worldwide. Rising fares and fees, fewer flight options, and difficult decisions about whether a trip is worth the cost. The culprit is volatile oil and jet fuel prices, which have spiked sharply since the war in the Middle East began, and fighting near the Strait of Hormuz created a choke point for global oil supplies. Volatility is the real story here, said Shai Gilad, G-I-L-A-D, a former airline captain who now teaches at Georgetown University's business school. Right now, the airlines are trying to make the best of what they think will happen in the future. Airlines are responding cautiously, trimming schedules and adjusting prices in ways that experts say will ripple unevenly across the market, but ultimately affect nearly every type of traveler. Budget airlines and the customers who rely on them are likely to feel the pinch first and most acutely, experts say. But even travelers in premium cabins won't escape the higher prices and less convenient schedules. Oil prices have swung wildly in recent weeks, briefly topping $119 a barrel at one point, plunging Wednesday below $95 on news of a two-week ceasefire that temporarily reopened the Strait of Hormuz and then climbed back towards $100 on Thursday. As uncertainty over the fragile deal grew, Iran again closed the key artery for global oil shipments in response to Israeli strikes Wednesday in Lebanon. When prices move quickly in both directions, it's very hard for airlines to make predictions, Gilad said. In other words, even when oil prices drop, travelers may not see relief right away. At this level of fuel, it's hard to call anything temporary, Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian told reporters this week, after the Atlanta-based carrier raised the checked-in baggage fee. Global squeeze, local effects. Bastian of Delta Airlines said Wednesday that Delta kicked off the earnings season for U.S. airlines, that the higher fuel prices are expected to add $2 billion in operating expenses in the second quarter alone. United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby said in a recent memo to staff that if fuel prices stay elevated, it could add $11 billion in annual costs. For perspective, Kirby wrote, in United's best year ever, we made less than $5 billion. According to the International Air Transport Association, the average global jet fuel price rose to $209 per barrel last week, up from roughly $99. At the end of February when the war started. Travelers from the U.S. to Hong Kong and New Delhi are paying the price. U.S. carriers are embedding the higher operating costs into ticket prices and add-on fees. Delta, United, American Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and JetBlue have all increased checked baggage fees. Both United and American are also moving beyond add-ons to adjust pricing. United said last week it is bringing the pay-for-what-you-want approach, already standard in economy, to its premium cabins, turning perks like advanced seat selection and fully refundable tickets into optional extras. American announced Thursday that passengers in basic economy will have to pay extra to pick their seat beginning May 18th, including elite tier loyalty members, and later this year, basic economy passengers without elite status or an eligible co-branded credit card will be assigned to boarding Group 7, while those with higher status will still board earlier, even when purchasing the lowest fares. Oh. Okay.
Is that the end of that?
No. Hong Kong's Cathay Pacific recently bumped fuel surcharges by roughly 34% across all routes, while Air India on Monday added up to $280 in fees to some flights. Emirates, Lufthansa, and KLM, the Royal Dutch Airline, have also adjusted fees or fares to keep pace with the prices of volatility. Experts say flexibility and careful planning can help offset these costs. Fare tracking sites can alert travelers to price changes and help them compare multiple options in one place. Booking early and checking nearby airports, oh, this is a hassle, can lock in better prices. While refundable tickets make it easier to cancel and rebook if fares drop. Traveling light with just a carry-on also helps avoid the rising bag fees. Flight cuts to cut costs. Adjusting the glasses. For business travelers, the cost of already shaping their decisions. Bill Morehouse, a solutions director who flies for work every 4 to 6 weeks, said the uncertainty may keep him closer to home for now. When you have business trips and you have a carefully coordinated schedule, you don't want unknowns and disruptions. And right now, it just feels like it's more likely that things could go wrong and throw your trip off course, the Cupertino, California resident said. Richard Groberg, an investment banker from Las Vegas who visits clients around the U.S., said he plans to book as early as possible to lock in the best fares. There's sometimes no substitute for in-person meetings and building relationships, he said. As travel becomes more expensive, that becomes a tougher decision to make those investments. Even family visits are on his mind. Groberg's brother hopes he'll stop in Vermont next time he's in New York for work. But Groberg admits, I start thinking maybe I should drive instead because this is getting so expensive. Airlines, meanwhile, are also adjusting how much they fly. The BNP Paribas estimates that global schedules for April have been cut roughly 5% compared with earlier plans. Most reductions are in the Middle East, and Global Investment Bank said, though smaller cuts were also emerging in Europe, Asia, and North America. Okay.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, my computer timed out. Okay. This is Merrimack Valley in a minute, and then I'm going to read another short one. So two articles. Roundup on slices at Sal's Pizza out of Lawrence. Sal's Pizza has announced its support of Best Buddies International through a Roundup campaign at participating restaurants, including the Lawrence Shop at 425 Merrimack Street. The campaign runs throughout April and May. Guests can choose to round up their total at checkout, with the additional funds supporting Best Buddies' mission to create inclusive opportunities and connections for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Customers will have the option to round up their purchase to the nearest dollar or donate $1, $3, or $5 when placing their order. This initiative is especially meaningful to all of us at SALS, said Sal Lupini Jr. It reflects our longstanding commitment to the community we serve and our belief in creating spaces where everyone feels a true sense of belonging. The campaign is available in-store and online at participating SALS Pizza locations in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, spots like Derry and Salem. The restaurant chain will continue to support May 30th by providing food trucks at the Best Buddies Challenge, Hyannisport, helping fuel participants and celebrate the impact of the Best Buddies community. Artisan Market returns May 31st out of North Andover. The Artisan Market at Mills is the largest handmade market in North Andover, and it's coming back from 10 to 3 on Sunday, May 31st, at 50 High Street. The event will feature roughly 100 artisans and specialty food vendors from all over New England. The market began the summer of 2018 as a collaboration between North Andover Farmers Market and the East and West Mills, with the Village Studio taking over in 2023. This will be a rain or shine event held in the parking lot behind the West Mill. Admission to the market and parking are free. Leashed, well-behaved dogs are welcome. For more information, contact the Artisan Market at the Mills at gmail.com. Boop the Snoot in Haverhill. Okay, Haverhill, Boop, B-O-O-P, the Snoot, a fundraiser to benefit Sweet Paws Rescue, will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. on June 6th at Wicked Axe, 721 South Main Street. The event is held in collaboration between the city axe-throwing venue, Sweet Paws Rescue, and Haverhill's Woof Stock, the city's annual dog festival. All right, that's that for Merrimack Valley. Let's go over to the next page and read another article. Next hearing in the murder case, June 26th, out of Methuen. The results of an autopsy in the case of a mother allegedly killed by her son will be available at the end of this week, according to prosecutors. On Thursday, Anthony Nunez Romano appeared via Zoom for a pretrial hearing from the Bristol County House of Corrections. Nunez Romano, 26, is accused of the murder of Domingo Romano, 55. His case was heard by Essex Superior Court Judge Salim Tabit. A compliance hearing is scheduled for June 26th. A trial date has yet to be set. During the hearing, prosecutor Kate McDougall said discovery was almost complete with the exception of an autopsy and ballistics report. Romano's body was discovered after police attempted to perform a well-being check December 29th. The visit came after Romano failed to respond to someone she had regular communication with. Nunez Romano and his mother shared a home on Lindale Avenue in Methuen. Nunez Romano met law enforcement at the door, according to a police report, and asked if he could go upstairs before police. Authorities found Romano's body upstairs, wrapped in a comforter with her face covered in paper towels. After searching the home, police found a 9mm handgun and what they believed to be 5 bullet holes spread across the walls and in the dining room window, according to documents. Nunez Romano was arrested, and he remains in custody since. Last month, another judge granted a request by the defense for the court to pay for a forensic examiner, neuropsychiatrist, and investigator. Family members expressed concerns about Nunez Romano's mental health during the investigation, according to documents. Besides a charge of murder, Nunez Romano is facing 2 related weapons charges, one of which is a felony. He had previously faced weapons charges during a 2019 crackdown on weapons and drug trafficking in the region, but the case had been dropped when a cooperating witness failed to identify Nunez Romano. Nunez Romano is being represented by Worcester attorney Joseph Perullo. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, we have this long. Artemis II astronauts describe their lunar voyage as surreal and profound. Article from the Associated Press by Marcia Dunn. Houston, drawing ever closer to Earth, the Artemis II astronauts tidied up their lunar cruiser for the upcoming fireball return and reflected on their historic journey around the moon, describing it as a surreal and profound experience. As the next to last day of their flight dawned, Thursday, humanity's first lunar explorers in more than half a century were less than 150,000 miles from home with the odometer clicking down. We have to get back. There's so much data that you've seen already, but all the good stuff is coming back with us.
Richard, talk into the mic. That's okay.
Okay. There are so many more pictures, so many more stories, said pilot Victor Glover, adding that riding a fireball through the atmosphere is profound as well. Being cut off from all of humanity for nearly an hour while behind the moon was especially surreal, according to Commander Reed Wiseman. There's a lot that our brains have to process. Okay, there's a lot that our brains have to process, and it is a true gift, Wiseman said late Wednesday during the crew's first news conference since before the liftoff. While out of contact behind the moon Monday, Wiseman, Glover, Christina Koch, and Canada's Jeremy Hansen became the most distant humans ever, clocking in at a record 252,756 miles from Earth before heading back. As they emerged from behind the moon, they experienced a wondrous total solar eclipse as the orb blocked the sun from their perspective. Launching from Florida on the 1st of April diminished the amount of illumination on the lunar far side, Glover noted, but the eclipse was the consolation prize, and it was one of the greatest gifts. While acknowledging anxiety over Friday's return, NASA Associate Administrator Amit Kshatriya, Kshatriya, said the crew's expressions of love and devotion to family have warmed hearts worldwide and served as a great example of why we go and do these missions. If you can't take love to the stars, then what are we doing, he said. That's why we send humans instead of robots sometimes. That's why we have the first-hand witness. Friday's reentry and Pacific splashdown off the coast of San Diego, that's today, as dynamic and dangerous as liftoff, now topped everyone's mind. The recovery ship USS John P. Mercer was already at sea, with a squadron of military planes and helicopters poised to join the operation. It's the first time that NASA and the Defense Department have teamed up for a lunar cruise reentry since Apollo 17 in 1972. Their Orion capsule will come screaming back, hitting the atmosphere at a predicted 34,965 feet per second, or 23,840 miles per hour. Not a record, but still mind-boggling fast. Flight director Jeff Ratigan said the capsule must nail the reentry angle within a single degree. Let's not beat around the bush. We have to hit that angle correctly. Otherwise, we're not going to have a successful reentry, he said. Mission Control will be paying close attention to how the capsule's heat shield holds up. During the only other Orion test flight to the moon in 2022, without a crew, the heat shield suffered considerably more damage than expected from the 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit of re-entry. Instead of replacing Artemis II's heat shield, which would have forced another lengthy delay, NASA tweaked the capsule's descent through the atmosphere to reduce the blisteringly hot exposure. Next year's Artemis III and beyond will fly with redesigned heat shields. Artemis III will see astronauts practice docking their capsule with a lunar lander or two in orbit around Earth. Artemis IV in 2028 will attempt to land two astronauts near the moon's south pole, setting the stage for what NASA hopes will be a sustainable lunar base. NASA officials have been loath to provide their risk assessment numbers for the nearly 10-day mission, acknowledging launch and entry as the biggest threats.
All right. Out of North Andover, student advocates for state religious holidays. An eighth grade homework assignment on Romeo and Juliet led to a high school junior advocating for religious holiday equity at the state level. North Andover High School student Mahak Shankla, 16, filled the bill with State Senator Bruce Tarr, Republican of Gloucester, on the issue last year, which is awaiting a decision on the State House floor. Shankla was invited to the State House March 11th to speak during Civics Learning Week about the importance of civics education, the bill, and youth involvement in democracy. Her journey to the State House began in Patrick McGravy's civics class at North Andover Middle School, but she recalled McGravy's first civics unit on identity and not wanting to learn about what she valued or believed in. You can't advocate for something you don't believe in, and you can't support something you don't understand, she said. For me, that true test came during a religious holiday. It wasn't until she was met with opposition to requesting an extra day on a homework assignment so she could celebrate Diwali with her family. She said it's a courtesy that was regularly extended to students requesting excused homework or absence of Good Friday, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. I think the same should be extended to my faith, but my eighth grade teacher refused, Shankla said. The opposition led to Shankla's civic project on the issue and presenting the topic to the school committee as an eighth grader. After the meeting, former superintendent Greg Gillian and then assistant superintendent Pamela Lothrop met with the young student and drafted a school district policy on excused absences to observe religious holidays beyond Christian and Jewish ones. The school committee unanimously passed it. During March's Civics Learning Week, Shankla also spoke about her role as the high school's model United Nations president, how students can be active participants in today's democracy, and the William Sims project she worked on with McGreevy and other students. She spoke at the event alongside state representatives. Shankla is no stranger to speaking on civic issues. She presented at past department and elementary school education civics showcases and had the chance to see how others were bringing change on a higher level. I realized passing a policy in our town did help, but only a few people, she said. I wanted to try to make it wider. Shankla first spoke at State House in her freshman year when the budget for civics education was proposed for cuts. The education bill on religious holiday equity is pending in the State House, but Shankla said she was happy she was about to bring light to an issue again last month. It can help other students feel motivated to bring about change themselves. Age is just a number, and if students speak loud enough, people will listen, Shankla said. Civics is not just a textbook definition of how a bill becomes a law, she added. It's a collection I'm sorry, it's a collective energy of all the individuals who refuse to accept this is just the way things are. I realized passing a bill in our town did help, but only a few people. I wanted to make it wider. That's pretty cool, and God bless that little kid for trying. All right, we have time for one quick something or other.
I don't have a quick one.
Well, then I'll do a quick something or other.
Okay.
All right, let's see what we've got.
Well.
All right, I got one.
All right.
Hang on. All right, Saugus man gets 10 years in prison for drug trafficking. Okay, Boston. A Saugus man was sentenced to 10 years in prison on Wednesday for his role in a drug trafficking conspiracy involving thousands of counterfeit pills containing methamphetamine and fentanyl. George Krabby, 47, was sentenced by U.S. District Court Judge Angel Kelly in federal court in Boston, according to United States Attorney Leah Foley. In November, Krabby pleaded guilty to two counts of conspiracy to distribute controlled substances involving 500 grams or more of methamphetamine, three counts of distribution of 50 grams or more of methamphetamine, one count of possession with intent to distribute 500 grams or more of methamphetamine, and one count of possession with intent to distribute 50 grams or more of methamphetamine, and one count of distribution of methamphetamine and fentanyl. In July 2025, Krabby was indicted by federal grand juries. Between December of 2024 and April 2025, Krabby repeatedly met with a cooperating source and sold thousands of counterfeit pills containing methamphetamine and fentanyl. On April 22, 2025, Krabby was a passenger in a vehicle stopped by law enforcement in Danvers. Krabby was en route to Salisbury to sell the cooperating source's 4,000 counterfeit pills containing methamphetamine. During a search of the vehicle, a shoebox was located containing 5,296 pills containing methamphetamine with a weight of approximately 2 kilograms, according to Foley. Valuable assistance was provided by the Massachusetts State Police and the Revere, Saugus, and Peabody Police Department. Assistant U.S. Attorney Samuel R. Feldman of the Narcotics and Money Laundering Unit prosecuted the case. Okay, and on that note, now we're going to take our morning break. We shall return shortly, and we thank you for listening thus far.
Two, 13, and 23. Thank you for joining Mary and I this morning.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the mid-60s overnight, increasing clouds, temperatures in the mid-40s, and for Saturday, sunny, beautiful, temperatures in the upper 50s. The sun rose this morning at 6:10, setting at 7:20 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years old, and inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ag Council. As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
It's what we were taught, trained, and told to do.
It could be for anything. Helping a friend move.
Listening to a fellow veteran for hours, at any hour of the day.
Or just simply making time for people. A neighbor, a loved one, or even a stranger.
We're often the first to help others. There's no question about it.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
Perhaps it's time to do for yourself what you would do for others.
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVAOLP Athol, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading the front page stories from the Washington Post. It's Friday, April 10, 2026. After Trump pauses war, Iranians fly flags of victory, not surrender. By Steve Hendricks. London. Shortly after President Donald Trump threatened to erase the whole civilization of Iran, all 6,000 years of it, the crowds came out into the streets of Tehran waving flags, and not white ones. They bore the green, white, and red banners of the still-standing Islamic Republic. Some set fire to the star-spangled ones of the superpower that, according to state media, they had just humiliated. Whatever the outcome of the unstable two-week ceasefire that the United States and Iran agreed to just before Trump's apocalyptic deadline, whether it becomes an enduring truce or a return to the violence that has upended life from Israel to Azerbaijan, the pause in hostilities did not begin with images of an unconditional surrender that the president repeatedly demanded. Exhausted Iranians may yet get a fortnight's respite from airstrikes, but Trump's central war objectives remain unmet, and hard questions are left unresolved. Each side is claiming victory, but neither is a clear winner. Trump launched Operation Epic Fury on February 28, demanding unconditional surrender, the elimination of Iran's nuclear program, and the destruction of its ballistic missiles. He, along with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said they hoped the attacks would lead to regime change. By those measures, Wednesday's scorecard after nearly 6 weeks of bombing makes for sober reading. Iran is battered but unbroken. The regime has not collapsed, it has hardened. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps still has weapons to fire, including ballistic missiles shot at Israel and Persian Gulf states in the hours after the ceasefire was announced, injuring two teenagers in Beersheba, Israel. Somewhere in Iran, a few hundred kilograms of enriched uranium remains as prospective raw material for a nuclear weapon. Trump's obvious and growing frustrations over Iran's death grip on oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz and spiking gasoline prices for increasingly disaffected voters led him to bring genocidal rhetoric to the social media feed of the American presidency. Iran's beleaguered leaders, for their part, agreed to let some tankers squeeze through without the promise of a permanent end to the war that they had demanded. Tuesday's dramatic agreement to hit pause seems less like an exit ramp than a rest stop for all sides. But without meaningful negotiations, likely to take more than 14 days, exhaustion alone will probably not be enough to keep the violence at bay. As of now, I see a return to the war as a more likely outcome than a meaningful settlement, said Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a London think tank. This is a breather, Vakil said. All sides are approaching this with a degree of skepticism, really, because the positions and the demands are very maximalist, and it's very hard to see where compromises can be found in a two-week time frame. In Lebanon, there was not even a breather, as Israel declared the ceasefire didn't apply to its ongoing military assault on Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militia, and intensified its bombing campaign, including targets in Beirut, the capital. Hezbollah launched counterstrikes on northern Israel, and as the attacks continued Thursday, British, French, and other European leaders called for the ceasefire to cover Lebanon as well, in keeping with an original statement by Pakistan, which helped broker the pause between the U.S. and Iran. Iran, meanwhile, has kept up its blockade of oil tankers in protest, a rebuttal to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who declared triumphantly at a Pentagon briefing that the war was a historic capital V military victory. There are going to be a lot of spoilers to watch out for in this process, Vakil said. Whether they're in Israel or Washington or in Tehran, parties are all going to be weighing in and polluting the environment for a settlement. Negotiations in Pakistan are expected to begin Saturday, with Vice President J.D. Vance leading the U.S. delegation. The sides have given themselves little time to untangle a decades-long enmity that in recent weeks produced a real cost in lives and civilian infrastructure, and now leaves a two-week clock ticking on questions that could define the Middle East for a generation. The talks presumably will use Iran's 10-point list of demands as a starting point, including ultimatums that the U.S. withdraw all its forces from the region, end sanctions on the regime, pay compensation for war damage, and cede Tehran permanent control of the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said he found much to be workable in that list, although he and his administration have rejected most of the provisions before. Given the distance between the sides, a return to the status quo before the war is one very possible outcome. Hopes by the U.S., Israel, and Gulf states that the pain of the war might at least end with a defanged Iran no longer reigning as the region's main state sponsor of terrorism and mayhem may yet slip away. The regime that the United States and Israel were eager to see fall may well endure for years. So far, it has achieved its fundamental goal of survival in the face of military onslaught. Whether it can persevere in the long term, amid a collapsed economy, devastated infrastructure, and a deeply oppressed but restive population, will depend on the terms it can wrest to end the war. With sanctions relief or compensation, they may be able to recover, Vakil said, but if they don't have that, they will be in a cycle of perpetual conflict, and the default for the region.
We are back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, interesting article. A conservative think tank reports post-pandemic data shows anemic job growth in Massachusetts.
Anemic?
Yes. Out of Boston, Massachusetts lost nearly 12,000 jobs over the past year, according to newly released federal data, which fiscal watchdogs suggests the state's post-pandemic labor market is still struggling to rebound. Data released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics this week shows that from January of 2025 to January of 2026, the state lost 11,600 jobs in key industries that have long anchored Massachusetts' innovative economy, including professional and technical service information and manufacturing. The updated figures also revise estimates of job losses from January 2022, January 2026, from 24,000 to 34,700, which the Boston-based think tank says put Massachusetts even further behind the national average of 4.65% job growth over that same period. The revised data are clear. Massachusetts' economic challenges run deeper than we thought, Pioneer Executive Director Jim Sturgios said in a statement. Over the past 6 years, the Commonwealth has lost the equivalent of every private sector job in Brookline, while business-friendly states have adapted jobs by the hundreds of thousands. Sturgios said while competitors states such as Texas, Florida, and North Carolina have continued to post strong private sector job growth since 2020, the revised data shows that Massachusetts has failed to keep pace by even wider margin than previously reported. He said the state job growth is anemic and will require meaningful differences in policy to turn around the labor market. Release of the new data comes after criticism that BLS's monthly job report, which includes the country's unemployment rate, the number of jobs created over the last month, and other labor statistics, overestimated job growth nationally and in the states in 2025. President Donald Trump fired the agency's former leader in August after it reported a sharp slowdown in job growth. He accused Commissioner Erica McEnterfer rigging the numbers. Oh my God. Allegations that were widely rejected by economists. But the new data also comes as business groups push for tax relief on Beacon Hill, with a plan inching towards the November ballot that would cut the state's personal income tax from 5% to 4% over 3 years. Another proposal by the coalition that has cleared several hurdles to the November 3rd election would overhaul the voter-approved 62F law, which requires Massachusetts to refund money when tax revenues grow by more than the wages and salaries. The Mass Opportunity Alliance, which includes Pioneer and the Massachusetts High Technology Council, is pushing both proposals as part of broader efforts to create more jobs and improve competitiveness. Governor Maura Healey, a first-term Democrat seeking re-election in November, has focused on improving the state's business climate as part of a broader effort to reduce the state's cost of living and improve its competitiveness. A tax relief bill Healey signed in October of 2023 included a slew of credits and other measures, including eliminating the tax for estates under $2 million and cutting the state's short-term capital gains tax from 12% to 5%, both key issues for business leaders. The $1 million plan included expanded credits for families and seniors, a higher estate tax threshold, and a reduced short-term capital gains rate tax. Oh, wow. But Healey has also faced criticism over support for the millionaire's tax, as well as recent proposals to hike taxes on prescription drugs, candy and tobacco products, among other tax initiatives aimed at plugging budget gaps. Over to you, Richard.
All right, commentary today. Rahm, R-A-H-M, Emmanuel ponders the plunge. Considering a run for president, by Jeff Robbins, the columnist. If they ever make a sequel to Dumb and Dumber, Rahm Emanuel mused to a packed hall at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire, last week. There's a lot of competition in this administration for who gets to play the lead. If there's one thing Emanuel isn't, it's dumb. He's not in New Hampshire to monitor the Granite State blossoming into springtime. He's there because he is seriously weighing running for president. And his appearance at the New England Council's Politics and Eggs breakfast at St. Anselm, for decades a must-stop for anyone considering running, showed why Emanuel has penetrated the national conversation about 2028. There are several firsts. This has happened first. There actually may be no candidate whose qualifications to be president surpass his. He has served as a top advisor to former President Bill Clinton, as a three-term U.S. congressman, as chief of staff to former President Barack Obama, a two-term mayor of Chicago, and ambassador to Japan. Excuse me. He not only knows government at every level, but he has been a high-octane, high-impact practitioner with a quality of experience that isn't easily ignored. Second, while other potential candidates can be difficult to listen to with their prepackaged, poll-tested pablum, Emmanuel doesn't sound like a cliché dispenser. He has been thoughtful about issues that no one else seems to be thinking about, and he discusses them bluntly. Those include national service, that sounds like the Peace Corps, corrosive effect on children of social media addiction, and the debacle that is the state of American education. Third, he is tough-minded and knows the levers of civic and political power as well as anyone. That may be putting it politely. There's little doubt that when it comes to American politics, the sometimes bare-knuckled Emmanuel not only knows where the bodies are buried, he may have buried some of them. Fourth, he presents an authentic, comfortable in his own skin, in the fashion of former Arizona Senator John McCain on his campaign bus during the 2008 dubbed Straight Talk Express. Emmanuel could not hide his innate impatience if he tried, and he doesn't look to be trying. When the moderator at St. Anselm's New England Council President Jim Brett began a question, "Are you worried?" Emmanuel quickly interjected, "Yes," to laughter from the crowd. Hand in glove with Emmanuel's reputation for impatience is his reputation for relentlessness, a reputation Emmanuel acknowledges. "I was ambassador to Japan for 4 years. For the Japanese government, it felt like 40, he said, to more laughter. And fifth, if there is any prospective candidate with more physical energy than Emmanuel, it would be surprising. A physical fitness fanatic, Emmanuel works out intensely every morning and regularly swims a mile." Wow. After the St. Anselm breakfast, he was headed to a meeting with the Manchester Union leader. Oh, an appearance on The View and a trip to South Carolina. To start binding things together in the country that has been torn apart and is rotting from the inside. Ooh. Emmanuel proposes that every young person be required to do at least 6 months of national service of some kind, with the option of doing more. "If you do 2 years," said Emmanuel, we give you a down payment on your first home." Ooh, houses are pretty expensive. "Having done something for your country will do something for you in return." He has called for the United States to follow other countries' lead in keeping children under 16 off most social media platforms, citing a growing body of evidence that they are wreaking serious mental health damage. "We've got to make a choice when it comes to our adolescents," he said. "I put my thumb on the scale for adults over algorithms." And he hammers away at the collapse of American education and has traveled to Mississippi to learn how America can learn from the Mississippi Marathon, which has catapulted that state from 49th to 9th. Wow. From 49th to 9th among the 50 states in reading. Emmanuel wears the root of his concern on his sleeve. "As a grandson of immigrants, I won the lottery of life," he says. "This country is a gift. It's time to give back that gift." And with that, he's off on the next stop.
Continuing with the value of reading, today's commentary by Tom Walters is similar, but I'm going to read it anyway. Literary classics never get old. Reading is a large part of my life. It always has been. My parents read voraciously. Is that the right word? And my wife does too. My tastes vary. History and historical novels, thrillers, and, in recent years, a return to or discovery of the classics. We've been watching the new television series, The Count of Monte Cristo, on PBS. It's beautifully done, but I realized that I haven't really read any of Alexander Dumas' books. My wife bought me the book as an Easter gift, and at this writing, I'm well into it. There is, however, a long way to go. I am not a total stranger to the work of Dumas. I have seen several screen versions of The Three Musketeers and its fascinating time period. So if I live long enough, I'll get the book and give it a go. French authors are largely extraordinary, but they're not what you'd call conservative or economic in their writing. If you've seen the musical Les Miserables, oh my God, I haven't, it goes on forever, and then got a copy of Victor Hugo's book, you realize the stage version is the essence of the story, but it only scratches the surface. Even with some modern stages and film adaptations like the Harry Potter series, reading the books gives the reader so much more than simply watching the movies. The complexity of the characters and the storylines, the historic references, the books provide much fuller, richer levels of appreciation and enjoyment. In my youth, I read War and Peace, oh God bless you, much of which I remember to this day, and yes, I've seen some of the screen adaptations. In high school, of course, we read Dickens, David Copperfield, Great Expectations, A Tale of Two Cities, that's an amazing book, and A Christmas Carol. I know some of the lines and phrases by heart. You wear the chains you forged in life. Bah, humbug. When I was a child, my mother would return from grocery shopping without something that we'd requested, and we would respond with, "It wasn't on sale, Scrooge." In school, there were also the many works of Shakespeare, Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, and The House of Seven Gables, Edith Wharton's Ethan Frome, and George Eliot's Silas Marner. My wife and I used the poetry of Elizabeth Barrett Browning at our wedding. In the event that you are curious, it was Sonnet 43, more familiarly known as How Do I Love Thee? It was beautifully read by my wife's principal. There is a new series on PBS titled The Foresights, which we have also started watching. It's based fairly loosely, but with some key references to and the great characters of John Galsworthy's three-volume epic, The Foresight Saga. My mother loved those books. She had all three volumes, which I read when I was young. The current masterpiece adaptation is the latest of several. It's the story of wealthy family in England, a British version of HBO's Gilded Age, that started in the late 1800s and proceeded through the volumes into succeeding generations, much like Ken Follett's sweeping multi-central epics. I've read those too. If you watched and liked Downton Abbey, you'll get the idea. A few years ago, I realized that there were other classics of which I was a bit ignorant. I bought copies of the Bronte sisters' Wuthering Heights. Oh, and Jane Eyre. Those were two of my favorites as a kid. They delivered absolutely intriguing and, one might admit, some seriously psychologically deformed characters. That's what makes the reading so much deeper and more memorable than just watching. On a side note, I had a cousin who lived in Nova Scotia on a bluff overlooking the Bay of Fundy. A severe winter storm and winds came in off the bay and the whole house shook. She could be heard to call out, "Heathcliff, Heathcliff." I now get it. Some years ago, I embarked on an epic Tolkien journey. I started, as most do, with The Hobbit, proceeding through the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They are wonderful books that truly capture the imagination, simplicity, and goodness to greed and evil. Where does true strength lie? In full disclosure, I have never seen the movie versions of those books, and I'm not sure I want to. Not that the screen versions are generally bad. They're just different. Not as your mind and your imagination see them. Images, characters, and storylines have been altered either slightly or significantly for dramatic effect, and you can't always go back. So I leave some to my mind to form my impressions and memories. So in 6 to 8 months, I've waded through the exploits of Edmond Dantès. Did I mention that I tend to read slowly? I'll let you know how Napoleon's Return from Elba works out. 2, spoiler alert, not well. And I'll tell you this. Revenge is much more interesting in classic works of fiction than it is as a principle of governance. Over to you, Richard. That was a great article.
Nice. In fact, Alexander Dumas, I was reading a book of his, was an adventurer that was traveling through kind of undeveloped Russia in the 1800s.
Hmm. Interesting.
Of course, he must have money behind him, too. All right. Russia's Putin declares a ceasefire in Ukraine for Orthodox Easter. Oh, that sounds like scheming here. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday declared a 32-hour ceasefire in Ukraine over the Orthodox Easter weekend. Putin's decree, released by the Kremlin, orders Russian forces to observe a ceasefire starting on 4 p.m. Saturday, which is tomorrow, and lasting until the end of Sunday. Putin's move follows Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's proposal earlier this week to observe a pause in attacks on each other's energy infrastructure over the Orthodox Easter. He said he made the offer through the United States, which has been mediating talks between delegations from Moscow and Kiev as the conflict stretches into a fifth year. Previous attempts to secure ceasefires have had little or no impact. Putin unilaterally declared a 30-hour ceasefire last Easter, but each side accused the other of breaking it. And then, drone strike hits a wedding in Darfur. All right, killing at least 30 people.
Oh.
Cairo. A drone strike on a town in Sudan's Darfur region hit a wedding party, killing at least 30 civilians, including women and children, the United States said Thursday. United Nations said Thursday. Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, said during a briefing that the wedding ceremony was in the town of Khartoum in North Darfur. The strike is the latest in an intensifying drone fair between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, who have been at war since April 2023. The nearly three-year conflict in Sudan killed more than 40,000 people, according to UN figures. But aid groups say the true number could be much higher. The Emergency Lawyers, a local rights group, and resistance committee in El Fashah, a grassroots group tracking the war, blamed the Wednesday attack on the Sudanese armed forces in statements released on Thursday on social media. And then more bad news. Venezuelans okay sweeping mining bill to lure foreign investors. Caracas, Venezuela. Venezuelan lawmakers on Thursday approved a bill to regulate the country's mining as it seeks to attract leery foreign investors to a once private industry that has long been exploited by criminal groups believed to have ties to the government. Well, that's not great. It is the latest legislative initiative by acting President Delcy Rodriguez since the self-proclaimed socialist government that has ruled Venezuela for 26 years came under the pressure from the Trump administration in January when the U.S. military deposed then-President Nicolas Maduro. The lengthy bill will now undergo a review by the country's high court to determine if it is constitutional. The bill regulates mining rights, establishes small, medium, and large-scale mining categories, and allows for independent arbitration of disputes, which foreign investigators view as key to guard against the government seizing their assets. Okay. Next, Venezuelan police block protesters demanding higher wages. Caracas, Venezuela again. Union leaders retirees, and public sector workers in the Venezuelan capital marched Thursday towards the presidential palace to demand higher wages and dignified pensions, only to be met by police blockades. The protest came the day after acting President Delcy Rodriguez went on national television to ask public and private sector workers for patience as her government works to improve the country's economy. Workers' wages for years have not allowed them to afford basic necessities. Many public sector workers survive on roughly $160 per month, while the average private sector employee earned about $237 last year. That must be per month. Call for elections and leave. That's what the Venezuelan workers want today, says Jose Patiniz, a marching union leader, referring to the country's government. Because if on May 1st they come with an increase of a few dollars, no, we don't need it. We want a salary with purchasing power.
Okay. I got something if you want.
Go.
Okay. So this is on the opinion page. Deep breaths, Sox fans, deep breaths. It's still early in the season. There are a whopping 150 games left to play, but we can almost hear the gnashing of teeth from Lawrence to Amesbury to Gloucester and Marblehead to Salem, New Hampshire, and Salem, Massachusetts. Baseball is a game that requires almost infinite patience, and it's something we Boston fans have always had in short supply. Who can we blame? After almost 15 years of aggressive moves that brought four championships in 2004, 2007, 2013, and 2018, owner John Henry and team management seems willing to step back, spend less, and reap the profits driven by rising ticket prices and $10 beers. Baby-faced Rafael Devers was traded in San Francisco for next to nothing last year. Sure, he would be petulant, but he would also clear the yard and drive in runs. Third baseman Alex Bregman, a steady veteran presence, was allowed to decamp for the Chicago Cubs in the offseason. The 2026 Red Sox, we were told, would win with pitching and defense. So far, the team ranks near the bottom of the pack in both categories, and the offense isn't much better. Young star Roman Anthony, who some have predicted to win the American League's Most Valuable Player Award this year, is hitting a becalmed .217 with more errors, too, than homers. The team enters the weekend at 4-8 in last place in the American League East, already 4.5 games behind the despised New York Yankees. It's all sitting as heavily and sourly in our stomachs as Fenway's newest food offering, lobster poutine, yours for only $39.99. And yet, the team has won its last two games behind the solid starting pitching of ace Garrett Crotchet, a new acquisition, Sonny Gray. The wins came not against pushovers, but against the Milwaukee Brewers, who won the most games in baseball last year. There was timely hitting and only one error. It doesn't take much to get Red Sox Nation back on board. We expect to pitch, manager Alex Cora said. If we pitch like we planned, right, and play good defense, we're going to be okay. 150 games to go. Deep breaths. And then I have a second letter to the editor. Letters to the editor. City Hall must confront its own lapses. The discovery that a surveillance camera capable of recording audio operated for years on the third floor of Lawrence City Hall without any notice to employees or visitors raises concern far beyond a technical lapse. Recording conversations in public buildings without signage, risking violating the Massachusetts wiretap law, and exposes the city to legal and financial consequences that residents should not be forced to shoulder. This does not seem to have been a passive security measure. The leaked recording of a heated conversation between two top officials all about proves the system functioned as a tool for workplace monitoring and control. Although the administration has ordered an outside review, it has yet to explain who authorized the installation of how equipment that never appeared before the City Council for budget approval was funded. The sudden exit of former Mayor Chief of Staff William Castro only deepens the uncertainty. The City Council, for its part, cannot claim distance. With the exception of newly elected members, councilors have walked past the cameras for years. The fact that a recording device was installed in a municipal building without the required legislative authorization reflects a breakdown in oversight that extends beyond the administration. A failure to ask questions is, in itself, a failure of governance. Lawrence residents deserve a full accounting. The administration must clarify who approved the system and what safeguards will prevent similar breaches. City Council members must recommit to their oversight responsibility. Transparency is not optional. It is the minimal standard for the public trust. Signed, Angel Rafael Rivera of Methuen. And then the other one, no place for hate here. To the editor, hate speech has no place in our community. Threats of violence have no place in our community. Unfortunately, people I know well have been seriously threatened in the last few weeks. This was particularly shocking after March 30th No Kings 3.0, which included 3,300 peaceful, joyful protests across the country and around the world. Unlike autocrats and their supporters who operate through violence, bullying, and threats, millions of our fellow Americans are committed to standing up for peace, civility, the Bill of Rights and the rules of law. Why? Because we share a deep, abiding love for our neighbors, our country, and our democracy. And that's signed Laura Harrington of Gloucester. Over to you, Richard.
All right.
Well, here goes. Netanyahu okays direct talks with Lebanon in a boost to ceasefire efforts. The photograph shows a group of people, a government supporter with others, weeps during a mourning ceremony marking the 40th day since the death of Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed in the U.S. and Israel strikes in Tehran. All right. Article by John Gambrell, Elena Becatoros, and Mike Corder of the Associated Press. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. In a potential boost to Middle East ceasefire efforts, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Thursday that he authorized direct negotiations with Lebanon as soon as possible, aimed at disarming Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants and establishing relations between the neighbors. The two countries have technically been at war since Israel was established in 1948. And Netanyahu later stressed that there was no ceasefire between them. In a video statement, he said, "Israel will keep striking Hezbollah until security is restored in northern Israel." There was no immediate response from Lebanon, but Israel-Lebanon negotiations were expected to begin next week at the State Department in Washington, D.C., according to a U.S. official and a person familiar with the plans, who spoke on condition of anonymity due to the delicacy of the matter. The prospect of talks appeared to bolster the tentative ceasefire in the Iran war that has staggered under the weight of Israel's bombardment of Beirut. Tehran's continued chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz and uncertainty over whether talks can find common ground. U.S. President Donald Trump said Thursday that he was very optimistic about the prospects of reaching a peace deal, saying Iranian leaders are more amenable in private conversations than in their public statements. Netanyahu's announcement came amid disagreement over whether the ceasefire deal included a pause in fighting. between Israel and Hezbollah. And a day after, Israel pounded Beirut with airstrikes. Ay, ay, ay. The deadliest day in Lebanon since the war began February 28th. Israel has fought multiple wars and launched several major invasions of Lebanon over the years, most recently sending in troops last month in response to Hezbollah fires on Israel's northern border communities. The launch of direct peace talks is a significant achievement. The launch of direct peace talks is a significant achievement, though reaching an agreement will be difficult after decades of hostilities. Hezbollah's continued presence and long-standing disagreement over the country's shared land border. The talks in Washington are expected to be handled on the American side by the U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, Michelle Issa, and on the Israeli side by the Israeli Ambassador to the U.S., Yichel Lita, L-E-I-T-E-R, according to the person familiar with the planning. It was not immediately clear who would represent Lebanon. The timing and location of the talks was first reported by Axios, A-X-I-O-S. After declaring victory with the ceasefire announcement, both Iran and the U.S. appeared to apply pressure on each other. Semi-official news agencies in Iran suggested forces have mined the Strait of Hormuz, a crucial waterway for oil that Tehran has closed. Trump warned that U.S. forces would hit Iran harder than before if it did not fulfill the agreement. What about all those mines? Questions also remain over what will happen to Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium at the heart of tensions, how and when normal traffic will resume through the strait, and what happens to Iran's ability to launch future missile attacks and support armed proxies in the region. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said in a message on Telegram that Iran's decision to accept a ceasefire was made unanimously by senior government leaders and approved by the Supreme Leader. He said the ceasefire is not a sign of weakness, but a way to solidify Iran's proud victories. Despite disputes over the ceasefire, it appears to have halted weeks of missile and drone attacks by Iran on its Gulf Arab neighbors and Israel, with no new launches reported Thursday. There were no reports of strikes by the U.S. or Israel targeting Iran. Israel vows to continue striking Hezbollah and Lebanon. Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Baghia Kalabaf, warned in a social media post Thursday that continued Israeli attacks on the Iran-backed Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon would bring explicit costs and strong responses. Khalifa has been discussed as a possible negotiator who could meet U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance this weekend in Islamabad. The White House has said Vance would lead the delegation for talks starting Saturday. That's tomorrow. Iran had said Israel's ongoing attacks on Hezbollah were violating the ceasefire agreement. Netanyahu and Trump have said they were not. Trump said Thursday that he asked Netanyahu to dial back the strikes in Lebanon. Dial back the strikes. I spoke with Bibi, and he's going to low-key it. I just think we have to be sort of a little more low-key, Trump told NBC News. Hours before Netanyahu authorized the negotiations with Lebanon, He said Israel would continue striking militants in the country with force, precision, and determination. Not nice.
All right. Today in history. Today is Friday, April 10th, the 100th day of 2026. There are 265 days left in this year. Today in history, on April 10th, 1998, the Northern Ireland peace talks concluded as negotiators signed the Good Friday Agreement, a landmark settlement to end 30 years of bitter rivalries and bloody attacks. Also on this date, in 1815, Indonesia's Mount Tambora exploded in the biggest known volcanic eruption in 1,000 years, one that altered global weather. Excuse me, about 92,000 people are thought to have been killed, including 82,000 who perished of starvation and disease, and 10,000 killed by its direct impact. In 1866, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was founded in New York by Henry Burr. In 1912, the British liner RMS Titanic set sail from Southampton, England, bound for New York on its ill-fated maiden voyage. In 1919, Mexican revolutionary Emiliano Zapata was assassinated by forces loyal to President Venustiano Carranza. In 1963, the nuclear submarine USS Thresher, SN-593, sank during deep diving tests east of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, killing all 129 aboard. In 1971, the U.S. table tennis team arrived in China at the invitation of the communist government for a goodwill visit that came to be known as ping-pong diplomacy. In 2010... plane crashed on approach in dense fog to the Smolensk airport in Russia, killing Polish President Lech Kaczynski, the First Lady, and 94 other government and armed force figures, as well as many prominent Poles. In 2019, scientists released the first image ever made of a black hole, revealing a fiery donut-shaped object in a galaxy 55 million light years from Earth. And lastly, in 2023, a Louisville bank employee armed with a rifle opened fire at his workplace, killing five people while live streaming the attack on Instagram. Police arrived and shots were still being fired inside Old National Bank and killed the shooter in an exchange of gunfire. Over to you, Richard.
Now, today in history is not the same in the Lowell Sun as what you read. There are pieces that you added on and other pieces that you deleted.
I'm just reading what was here.
Yeah. Okay. Several Nigerian soldiers were killed during assault on a base. Abuja, Nigeria. Several soldiers were killed during an attempt to raid a military base in northeastern Nigeria early Thursday, the country's military said. The attack occurred in Benishiku, in Borno State, Army spokesman Michael Onoja said in a statement, but it was repelled. Onoja described the assailants as terrorists, which is the term the military uses to describe members of Islamic militant groups in the northeast of the country. Onoja didn't specify how many soldiers were killed in the latest attack on military bases. He said that Brigadier General Osini Brahma led the troops. This attack is a clear indication of the desperation of terrorist elements who, having suffered significant losses in recent operations, continue to resort to futile and ill-fated offenses against well-defended military positions, he said. Regrettably, the encounter resulted in the loss of a few brave and gallant soldiers who paid the supreme price in the line of duty. Yeah. All right, now we have another thing that's not so great.
Well, how long is it? We got to wrap up by 5:00.
It's two columns.
Okay.
Trump administration proposes gutting rules targeting coal plant ash that threatens groundwater. Not so good. We don't even have water to drink anymore, killing everything else. By Michael Philippus, P. PHILLIS, and Alexa St. John, Associated Press. The Trump administration on Thursday proposed weakening rules for the disposal of ash produced by burning coal that can contain hazardous heavy metals and contaminate groundwater. Yeah. Those regulations were strengthened under the Biden administration as part of a wider crackdown on pollution from coal-fired power plants. The Trump administration proposes easing standards, so do more polluting, for monitoring and protecting groundwater near some coal ash, near some coal ash sites, and rolling back rules that require the cleanup of entire coal properties rather than just the sites where ash was dumped. The revisions would also make it easier to reuse coal ash for other purposes, like what? EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin says the proposal reflects the agency's commitment to restoring American energy dominance, strengthening cooperative federalism, and accommodating unique circumstances at certain coal facilities. Burning coal produces tremendous amounts of ash, a waste product that contains heavy metals such as mercury, lead, and cobalt. If not stored properly, and how is that done, coal ash can contaminate groundwater. Coal plants are often situated on the banks of rivers or other waterways, with waste ash sitting nearby. Opponents say the proposal, which grants states and other regulators the ability to grant exemptions from national standards, may open the door for companies to leave coal ash sitting in groundwater. Not good. The Biden-era EPA in 2022, for example, rebuffed the General James Gavin power plant in southern Ohio for trying to close a coal ash disposal site that the agency said was in contact with groundwater. In January 25, with Trump back in the White House, coal industry entities asked Zeldin to revise the agency's stance on the issue, opening the door to leaving ash in groundwater undermines one of the central protections of this rule. And that's essentially what this does, said Nick Torrey, an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, a nonprofit. The agency's proposal does state that an owner would be required to ensure that the ash poses no reasonable probability of adverse effects on human health and the environment. Well, if it goes into groundwater and people are breathing this stuff and drinking it, the Biden-era coal ash protection also required the cleanup of places like the Michigan City Generation Station in Indiana, okay, by Lake Michigan. Oops. Local activists are worried about the land created at the site, which is composed in part of coal ash. The 2024 rules set deadlines for cleanup. At Michigan City and many other sites, standards to clean up the coal ash used to make land would be eliminated under the agency's proposal. The proposed rule also seeks to lift restrictions on the use of coal ash, called beneficial use, by the EPA. In secondary materials such as cement and structural fill. God. The agency also said that industry and others have said the health risk from coal ash were overstated in previous EPA assessments. Federal officials said the estimated cost savings were more than enough to justify the proposed changes. So it's advisable to breathe poison? The owners of the Gavin power plant declined to comment. The owners of the Michigan City Generation Station did not immediately comment. The Utility Solid Waste Activities Group appreciates EPA's efforts to address the significant challenges our members are facing in implementing the existing regulations. John Makacich, executive director of the industry association, said in a statement. He added the group supports changes that move away from the existing one-size-fits-all framework and incorporate site-specific flexibility, an approach that is common in other environmental programs. The genesis of these rules in current context. The EPA first set standards for coal ash during the Obama administration. They included requirements for companies to line new storage sites, monitor water, and close leaky ponds, often requiring the materials to be moved elsewhere. Wow, some other unlucky community. In 2024, then President Joe Biden's administration eliminated exemptions that had been granted to some older coal ash sites. The move is the latest in a series of Trump administration efforts to weaken clean air and water standards. Mm-hmm. What's he going to drink?
We got to hurry up.
Okay. All right. So the relief for the fossil fuel industry. It's also in line with the Republican President Donald Trump's efforts to boost U.S. coal and suppress clean air alternatives, all the while declaring a national energy emergency. All right.
Okay. On that long long article, we're going to wrap up for this week. We thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune in to LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane and Richard. We thank you for listening. And if you're going out this weekend, the weather's supposed to be very nice, actually. So get outside, do something fun, plant some flowers. If the ground's soft enough, just take a walk, whatever. But whatever you do, be kind to one another, be safe, and enjoy your weekend. Thank you.
At work, Rain said. He knew his job. Apopo trains rats using positive reinforcement, teaching them to identify chemical compounds and explosives such as trinitrotoluene. When a rat detects a landmine, it scratches the surface, alerting its handler. The rat is then rewarded with a treat, typically a peanut or a slice of banana. Rats are well suited to this work, Rain said, mainly due to their small size and highly developed olfactory system. They're so light they wouldn't trigger a landmine, Rain said. Plus, they have an extremely sensitive sense of smell, and they're quite intelligent. Cambodia has one of the world's highest concentrations of landmines, largely stemming from the Khmer Rouge era in 1979 and the Vietnamese occupation between 1979 and 1989. In the past 47 years, landmines in Cambodia have caused about 18,800 deaths and 45,000 injuries. Apopo started training mine detection rats in 2015, which helped speed up the efforts to locate mines, though an estimated 6 million landmines remain in Cambodia, according to Apopo. Millions of mines have been cleared. However, there's still a huge task ahead of us, Rain said. Cambodia's target is to be landmine-free by 2030. Mugabe's individual impact is remarkable, Rain said. He cleared more than 1.52 million square feet, roughly 26 football fields, and detected dozens of landmines. In 2020, Mugabe became the first rat to receive the PDSA Gold Medal, which rewards animal bravery and devotion to duty. That concludes this Friday's reading from the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the mid-60s overnight, increasing clouds, temperatures in the mid-40s, and for Saturday, sunny, beautiful, temperatures in the upper 50s. The sun rose this morning at 6:10, setting at 7:20 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300